Sitting in a living room, sitting on the porch. It's your words, gonna light that torch. Tell it in a city park, tell it in a bar. Tell it in the backseat of your grandma's car. No tales too pure, our failures lure. The poor house sure wants to hear what's bubbling in your brain.
Welcome to the second episode of Tales from the Poor House, the show where writers, in short order, respond to a prompt, write, then read. This week we have the second installment of writing based on the prompt, What the Barber Confessed. My name is Jeff Herbach, and this week my story's first up. I've got three sisters, and they're dumb. They think they're cute, but they're not. They're dumb. They're unified against me because I tell them what I think. This afternoon, over a lunch of Chef Boyardee ravioli, I stared at them and shook my head, the truth of the situation burning my eyes. What are you looking at, dork? My sister Velma asked. Not much, I said, the truth dripping forth. Why do you have such an ugly face? My sister Shelley asked. This is just my face, I said, my truth like poison. Then your face is ugly, 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 Carrie, my other sister said. Why don't you stick it, I shouted. Why don't you get a haircut, Velma shouted back. You're a shaggy, stinky dog. Dumb. I'm not a dog. I'm a person. See my skin? Dogs don't show their skin unless they're diseased. And that's an accident. I'm flesh and blood. I'm not diseased. I don't think. Maybe. Still, they're so dumb. I went upstairs and looked in the mirror. It was true. I could use a haircut. My barber is an old gray-headed man named Jed. He's got a big belly that touches my ear while he does his job. While he works chopping away, he gives out tidbits of wisdom he believes are gifts from God, which he receives in the shower, especially when he's washing his hair, because hair is his vocation and God loves those who know themselves best. He told me that back when Dad first took me to him. I sat in his chair and he rolled up his sleeves and clapped his hands together. What'll it be this time, Mikey? He asked. Short as hell. Sheer short. Shorty short, short, short. Oh. Why's that? He asked. My dumb sisters called me a shaggy dog. Homely truth is unpalatable, he said. What? I asked. Just a little wisdom from the Almighty, he said. I don't get it, I replied. He didn't give me a shorty short, short, short. He gave me a new haircut, though, which was a bowl cut, even though he didn't use a bowl. The long hair on the top of my head never looked so straight. You take care, young man, he said. I should punch your big gut, I wanted to say, but I didn't. Put my new do on my mom's account, is what I said. At home, I found my three sisters opening bottles of beer with a metal punching glove can opener. My dad said he pulled off a dead kraut, even though he wasn't even born the last time we fought the krauts, and he was never in the army. You can't drink that, I shouted. Stick it in your nose, doggy do, said Velma. Yeah. Nice hair. You look like a Chinaman, said Carrie. What the hell does that mean? I cried. Make of it what you will, said Shelley. I'm telling Mom about the beer, I cried. Mom knew all about the beer. She said, since my sisters were all within a year or two of 18, that she was educating them to be adults. In Germany, she said, girls learn to drink when they're still in diapers. What? What? I shouted. Then, by the time they're 18, beer is no longer of interest to them. They're only concerned with getting good jobs, staying trim, and finding the right man. Diapers, I screamed. You look vaguely Asian today, my mother said, squinting her eyes at my forehead. You've never been to Germany, I cried. Well, you know, your father, she said. Back at Jed, the barber's shop, I said, listen, old man, you've got to do something about my hair. I cut it 3 hours ago, he said. I look Asian, I shouted. What's wrong with that, he asked. I'm an American, that's what's wrong with that, I said. He closed his eyes, lifted his arms, and said, all I care to know is that a man is a human being. That is enough for me. He can't be much worse. What are you saying? I asked, feeling insulted. Just a little wisdom from the Almighty, Jed said. I asked for a shorty short short short, but Jed gave me highlights and somehow a loose perm. Chemicals is what he told me. Then he said, you owe me $33, my friend. Mom's account, I whispered. That's the last one I give you. She owes me $90. I almost didn't want to enter my house, but I was hungry, and I didn't have enough money to buy Taco Bell, the closest restaurant. Since Dad ran off to Germany to be with his internet girlfriend, there was never any money. I was greeted in the foyer by my three sisters. They held a plastic bag filled with quarters. They smelled like wet dog and perfume. Out of our way! Shelley couldn't even complete her sentence. What is that? Velma covered her mouth. Your head! Your head looks like Benji's butt! Shouted Carrie. You're drunk, I cried. Mom gave us money to go buy some more. And she gave us her ID. She's 42, I cried. They don't care if it's real at the Asian market. You only have to have it, you little dog, Velma hissed. They pushed past me and onto the street, shouting at neighbors and rattling their plastic bag filled with change. Where did you get that money? I shouted at them. I ran into the kitchen and found my mom hunched over her Sudoku. Nine. Nine. Nine, she whispered, an empty beer bottle next to her hand. Mom, I said. Mom, I asked. Mom, I growled. She didn't look up. Mom, I screamed. Her watery eyes left the Sudoku book and slowly rode my belly, chest, neck, up to my forehead. Oh, my God, she cried. What the hell is that? Where did they get that money? I whispered. Is there a costume party? She asked. Where did they get that money? I said. Have you glued a dog bottom to the top of your head? She asked, shaking her head. I ran upstairs, sweating, to look in the mirror. My bowl, probably due to sweating, had become a tightly curled perm. It was tortoiseshell in color, much like the color of the dog Benji in the movie For the Love of Benji we owned on VHS, which we watched 1,000 times. Oh my God, I cried. In the middle, twisted tight, a bunch of my hair fell forward, a dreadlock. It looked exactly like a dog tail. Oh my God, I cried. I ran to raid my money box from barber money. I mean, not my money box, but the box of money I had from selling chocolate bars to fund the school band trip to the Capitol. I picked it up. It was empty. All the quarters gone. You bitches, I cried. Jed was closing the barbershop as I got there. He turned out the lights, unlit the swirling barber pole, and was just shutting the door to lock up. I ran up and grabbed his hand. Jed, I shouted. Barber, I cried. You put a dog's butt on my head. He squinted, looked close, reached up and tugged my tail. Would seem that way, he said. He smiled. I look like an idiot. Clothes make the man, he said. Naked people have little or no influence in society, he nodded. What? I shouted. Just a little wisdom from the Almighty, he said. Cut this hair off, I cried. My sisters are driving me crazy. You have money, he asked. No, but Mom has no money, he said. But you have to fix what you didn't pay for in the first place, he asked. I have a dog's butt on my head. Let's be thankful for the fools, he said. But for them, the rest of us could not succeed. Little wisdom from the Almighty, I said. Kid, he said, let me confess something. What? I do not like your family. What? Your dad was right to go. He turned and walked away, strutting down the street, his big belly shaking. Hey, I shouted after him. You're really annoying. Thank you. Casey Fobb used to live in Iowa, where he watched Law & Order spinoffs religiously. Now he lives in Minnesota, where he chases squirrels and writes stuff from time to time. Casey.
So I asked the guy, can you fix it? He looked at me through the mirror. He shrugged as if to say, it's not so bad. I didn't even want to go to this guy in the first place. My hair looked fine, but my wife insisted. 3 days before my brother's wedding, and I listened to my wife's recommendation. I'm sure he's fine, she told me. This is why I don't ever take my wife's advice. Bad things happen. The guy, this barber, took out a chunk of my hair that clearly was not supposed to be taken out. He had whipped those clippers around my scalp like it was a damn NASCAR track. I have a light touch, he told me. I know what I'm doing. Then I felt the jab above my ear, the sharp scraping of a motorized blade against my flesh. It was hot and sent vibrations through my skull. I thought I was having a seizure. But then I thought, oh, I must have jerked. I must have moved. That's what caused the clippers to crash against my scalp. Then I saw him in the mirror with that look, that oh shoot look when you accidentally stab somebody with your hair clippers. That look that tells everyone, you screwed up. Well, I can take everything else down a little closer, he said. Closer how? Like bald? He rested his hands on his hips. He wore a white coat like he cured cancer all day. Instead of gnashing holes in hairdos, he was bald. What kind of barber is bald? Not the good kind. Not bald, he said, just shorter. I really don't have much left to work with, I told him. He nodded. He nodded and he blinked his beady little hairdressing eyes. Then he flipped the switch of the clippers. Whoa, whoa, I said. I think we should discuss this. He turned the clippers off. He walked around the chair and bent down to my level like I was a child, not a victim. Come on now. I stared him in his brunette eyes. He smelled like toffee and Tresemme. I shook my head. I think we're done here, I told him. Trust me, he said. This happens all the time.
Maggie Ryan Sanford lives in a tiny little hole overlooking one of St. Paul's most beautiful avenues. She's a writer and performer, and you're going to enjoy it. So, tune your ears to Maggie.
An address to my fellow residents of Surrency, Georgia, on July the 25th, 1866. Dear sirs, it is neither with guilt or the admittance of guilt that I come before you today, but rather with the noble, unsullied, and indisputably democratic intent to defend myself against the charges for which I have been accused. In regards to the alleged events of the fortnight precedent, it is no secret that there are those among you who feel I have done wrong, that I have trespassed against the members of this community in such a way as to be punished by the harshest procedures known to law. Then I ask you, does or does not the letter of the law address the matter at hand? Here I pause for effect. The facts, if we may all agree, are as follows. 1. I, Bucephalus Cradle Camp Clyde, herein referred to as I, was lately found to be in possession of a meager collection of hair, shorn from the heads of less than 3 dozen men and boys in the city of Surrency and the surrounding area thereof. 2. I, it can hardly be disputed, came about these clippings harmlessly and well within my capacity as barber shaver to this municipality, and, indeed, of the surrounding area thereof. 3. Furthermore, I have been found to have in my possession a number of miniature organisms that are not unlike humans in form, which some may know by the name homunculi, or singular, homunculus. I herein refer to said homunculi by the decidedly more agreeable term which I have chosen for them, Jeffreys. At the time of their discovery, the Jeffreys slumbered harmlessly in their jars, fully contained and wholly content, as evidenced by the expressions of vacant gratification on the face-like folds in the ventral surfaces of their headish protrusions. It could be noted that the Jeffreys were similar in number to those locks borrowed from the heads of my customers. This I do not deny. With respect to the court, I take it upon myself to further assume that certain qualms and queries may yet be lingering in the minds of those present. Will the Jeffreys, upon reaching maturation, bear resemblance in physical, mental, or spiritual arenas to the esteemed members of our community from whose heads were plucked their primordial fibers? Let me assure the court, this cannot be. A homunculus, I have come to expect from my extensive studies on the subject, has not the same sensibilities as you and I, lacking as he is in the ability to derive pleasure from those very elements that separate us from the animals. Art, literature, and furthermore, culture and or cultures of any kind. Likewise, will the Jeffreys, in their fully matured states, become inclined to behave in a manner improprietous to the gentlemen and scholars among us today, and indeed to our lady folk? I tell you now, they will not. The homunculus, I am led to believe, is a mild-mannered sort, possessing a worldview no larger than the confines of the bottle in which he was born, and he exists in his mind, and above all, to bestow service upon the men who have delivered him from obscurity, and breathed into him, as would a god, the very air which gives him life. Here I may pause again for effect. For here it is I have arrived at the purpose of my speech, and indeed the purpose of the experiment for which I stand here accused. Service. The Jeffrey is clean, conveniently sized, and inexpensive to accommodate. He has not the capacity to experience those human emotions which we know to be inconvenient when exhibited in human subjects. Loneliness, melancholy, pain, and the complaints that may arise hitherto. And so in closing, I trust the court will find this to be my best defense, utility. See me not as a trespasser, a thief. I do not trample upon your way of life. Rather, I aim to preserve it. Consider me, if I may, your savior. My father, God rest his soul, was a barber shaver to this municipality, as was his father and his father before him. 'Twas he who first showed me that the job of a barber is the most noble of all, to shave those who cannot shave themselves. In considering my actions here, think only of this. Let the Jeffreys shave us. Let the Jeffreys shave us all. Thank you.
Smoke is me say before I go, there are some things you'll never know of love and hair and love and quest of such a man with such finesse, of such a girl with much repressed. The way he talked when she undressed, he talked with such finesse. The barber, the barber, the barber, the barber was the best. Hey, hey, baby, wish us all the best.
That was the lovely and amazing Linnea Moan with an original song about the barber, with lyrics by Stephanie Wilbur Ash. Let's move on.
Our next reader this evening, Jim Burt. He's a first-year MFA student at Minnesota State. He spent half his life on the East Coast, half on the West, and is now trying out the center left.
I hopped up into the barber chair. I'm a little nervous, I felt like saying, "It's my first time, be gentle." My mother had always cut my hair, it shows. I could be cliche and say it's a mop, but that would be giving it too much credit. I just gulped and sank into the chair. "I gotta warn you," the barber said, snapping the bib a few times like it was a whip and he was pissed. "I quit smoking yesterday." "Cigarettes?" I asked. I knew right away it was the wrong thing to say. All I need is a crazed tobacco junkie standing behind me with a pair of scissors pointed at my head, mumbling, "Damn hippies." 40 years, he sighed. "Yes," I yelled inside. He didn't hear me. "Wait, 40 years? Why stop now? You're going to be dead in another 10 anyway. Enjoy yourself, man." What I really said was, "Wow, that's a long time." Pushing the pack of Camels deeper into my shirt pocket, I asked, "What made you quit?" "Business," he said, tying the bib around my neck. "It's always business." He inked the string tight right on the biz half of the nest. I hacked. He turned away. I gripped the armrest. He turned back. I turned blue. "Sorry, too tight?" "No, it's fine." "Okay, maybe a little." He loosened it. "Sorry, I've been getting a little tense lately. A little on edge." "Well, don't jump off while I'm in the chair," I wanted to tell him. "I quit smoking yesterday," he said again. "Don't ask, don't ask. Don't ask," my head told me. I was about to congratulate him when he stomped down on the pedal thing like he was killing ants. I lurched up about 10 inches, one at a time. My lunch felt like a bag of quarters in my belly. I thought it was going to lurch up too. In fact, it did. I swallowed hard and $1.50 went back down. I cleared my throat. I think there was still a nickel in there. "It was my wife's idea," he said. "So what are we looking at here?" "Oh, man," I thought. He caught me looking at the picture of his three daughters that was up on the shelf. I swallowed hard again. That nickel finally went down, and I was about to lie about something when he said, "Want me to just shave it all off?" "Oh, the hair. You were talking about the hair, right?" Well, I started to say. "Tell me what you want me to do," he said, tapping the scissors in the back of the chair. "I want you to untie me so I can get the hell out of here," my head said. What I said was just a trim, I guess. He started in, and then he started in. "Yeah, my wife said my customers' kids was complaining about the cigarette smell on my fingers." Well, I thought, there's worse things they could smell like. I looked up at the picture again and thought, well, there's better things too. "I've been barbering all my life," said. "Ain't no one ever complained before." Well, I thought, that's because all the kids used to smoke too and probably didn't notice. I wouldn't. "The times they are a-changing," I said. Oh, here comes that damn hippies line again, probably. "Well, I don't like it," he stomped in the pedal again. 50 cents went back up into my throat. He snipped and he stopped. "You know," he said, "yeah, I know I'd rather my mom was cutting my hair because she knows when to shut the hell up. And she's not a shaky nutcase about to kill me with a pair of blunt scissors." "No, what?" I asked. I need a cigarette. This is what the bartender confessed. I made the sign of the cross, started a Hail Mary, absolved him of his sins, and told him I would join him if he did, thinking it was really my one chance to run.
Nice.
Rick Robbins misses trout fishing and the bump of freight cars heading out on winter mornings. But he does not miss at all the sound of the grumpy neighbor on Spring Hill Place, Los Angeles, 1959. Rick?
This is what the barber confessed. Half dead. I was driving to North Platte, half dead, ready to kill my brother-in-law for giving my sister a black eye. She'd emailed a picture of herself, sans the pair of turquoise sunglasses she'd wear for the next month. It looked like he'd hit her with a bag of quarters or a gold glove, the real metal kind of gold glove, the kind that would hurt, that would leave a tiny blue-black pillow under your eye. I was going to cut his throat with this very razor. I was going to kill him in the field behind his stupid one-car garage he filled with two Ryder lawnmowers, one for the lawn and one with the rotor blade removed so he could ride it in the Sandhill Crane Days parade each year. He'd pull a little trailer with a sign showing two cranes in a mating dance and a bubble above the more aggressive male reading, "Come with me to the sandbar." I pulled into town half dead at 1 a.m., 13 hours from Chicago. Half dead because I'm not young anymore, because I shouldn't have to put up with this crap. Why did my lovely 37-year-old red-headed sister, who really should have learned a thing or two from a small lifetime of false start romances and a marriage to a two-timing futures trader and cattle seaman, why did my sister, one of three in a posed studio portrait surrounded by daisies and sunflowers and bunnies, think she'd ever find true love at a cage fight and with the loser of not one but all three matches? Every day I hold people's lives in my hands, like right now. I could subtract an ear from the side of your head in one motion and change your world forever. At minimum, I could layer your hair in such a way and in such an inconspicuously off-balance fashion so that people would be convinced you were retarded. I'll admit, I think about this stuff. All the way to North Platte, I rehearsed the torture my brother-in-law would endure at my hands, first behind his stupid one-car garage and then at the quarry outside of town. But there he was at the motel waiting for me, half dead, when I checked in at 1 a.m. "How's it going, Gus?" he asked. "My name's Giuseppe, but don't you dare call me that. I heard you were coming to town, so I've been waiting for you to give you my side of the story." All this followed by blah, 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 how hard my sister is to live with, which isn't new information, and blah, 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 how the recession has hit North Platte particularly hard, and did I know that it had tragic effect on couples, and blah, 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 would I like to go have a whiskey and a beer back at Wild Bill's before last call. Okay, I didn't kill him, which is good, because I've been a lifelong pacifist, even if I am from Chicago. Before we went into the bar, though, I pushed my cage-fighting brother-in-law against the wall with the Wild Bill Hickok mural, where he gallops through a storm of bullets and lightning bolts. I held him to the wall with four of my five fingers around his neck. I was saving the fifth in case I needed it. I told him he didn't have a tenth of the complaints against my sister that I had. She'd told a girlfriend of mine in high school about my fondness for peanut butter and mayonnaise sandwiches. She'd told my college roommate about how I studied people's heads when they weren't looking, even though it was all about the hair, which made my roommate think I was gay. She'd told the landlord back in Chicago about the party we were going to have at the turn of the century, which he came to, and where he drank all the rum, and where he threw up in the hall, and then evicted me 2 weeks later. "So, Francis," I said said to my brother-in-law, who I decided now was pitiful, kicking his little ankles at me while I pinned him to the buckskin shirt of Wild Bill. Francis, I said, you have nothing on me, and besides, it's not manly to hit women. If you promise not to do it again, I will promise not to kill you this year, and I will buy you a drink, and the next time you're in Chicago, I will cut your hair so you look like a man, and not the pitiful, almost squealing pig man or bird man you seem to have become. Not too much off the side, said the man in the chrome and leather chair.
That's all for What the Barber Confessed. Thanks so much to KMSU and the English Department of Mankato State University. We'll see you next time.
Backseat of your grandma's car, no tales to peer, our failures lure, the poorhouse sure wants to hear.